Hello, welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, June 25th, 1998. In the Creekside Room this evening is Carol Plain. Today's session number is 98-3, and it's titled Forgiveness and Healing. Let's listen in.
Okay, I think we're going to start so you can roll this tape and we'll just begin here. My name is Carol Plain, and I'm just here this week to share what I think is some of the greatest literature, because it just gets you right to the point. It doesn't take 100 pages like James Michener does to get you started. It's over in 32 usually. And yet I think children's books have a lot to offer. They're getting better and better. The illustrations are getting better and better. And I just think that they very often capture very quickly a thought, something that really helps us to understand the world. And I'm going to share with you tonight two different practices from the book Practicing Our Faith. And the first one is on forgiveness and the second one is on healing, which I think are very close together, really. And something that we all have to work on. None of us have perfected our forgiveness, nor have we perfected the great art of healing. So I think that we can be thankful that people still help us along the way in that thing. So, we're going to start, and I'm going to share with you, first of all, a book that I think shows pure grace, which is part of forgiveness. It's by Lorna Balliam, who's written a lot of books, and it's called Sometimes It's Turkey, and Sometimes It's Feathers. And if you're not familiar with Lorna Balliam, she's great. Little old Miss Gum found an egg, and she was hunting for wild mushrooms, and they're on the ground. Nearly hidden in a neat nest of leaves was a large cream-colored egg with freckles. Yes, indeed, an egg with freckles? Imagine. So she filled her mushroom basket with soft new April grass, and she placed that egg gently in the center, and she hurried home with her treasure. Mrs. Gum was so excited she almost stepped on Cat, who was sleeping on the steps. "Wake up, Cat," she said. "Wake up and look at our Thanksgiving dinner." An egg, Cat. A freckled egg. A genuine turkey egg, I do believe. "We'll try to hatch it, Cat," she said, covering the egg with a soft piece of flannel and setting it in a warm place. "We'll hatch it, and we'll feed it, and we'll let it grow plump. Oh, what a fine Thanksgiving dinner we'll have. Imagine." So for days and days, they watched it. And they watched it, and they turned it, and they warmed it, until finally, one day in May, tap, 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 and there on the freckled egg was just a tiny crack. Tap, 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 and the crack became a tiny hole. And they watched, and they listened, and they listened, and they watched. "Oh, it's hatching, Cat," said Mrs. Gum. "Oh, what a fine Thanksgiving dinner we're going to have." And it was a sticky, wet, bony little lump that tumbled out of that cracked, freckled shell. And as it dried, it became a fuzzy little lump with beady black eyes and a sharp beak. "He's hungry, Cat," said Mrs. Gum. "We'll feed him oatmeal and fatten him up." "What a fine Thanksgiving dinner we'll have. Imagine." Did that turkey eat? He ate everything in sight. Oatmeal, Wheaties, cornmeal, and bread, seeds, nuts, insects, sand, and cat food. And did that turkey grow? "Turkey's growing fat, Cat," said Mrs. Gum. "He'll be plenty big for Thanksgiving dinner." So in June, while Mrs. Gum was planting seeds, Turkey was eating the strawberries. And while Mrs. Gum was looking for strawberries, Turkey was eating as many seeds as he could find. "Never mind, Cat," said Mrs. Gum. "The more he eats, the plumper he gets." And what a fine Thanksgiving dinner we'll have. Just imagine. So Turkey ate raspberries in July, red raspberries, black raspberries, white, unripe raspberries, green peas, inchworms, grass seeds, and cat food. Said Mrs. Gum, "Raspberry jam would have been tasty with our Thanksgiving dinner, but at least there'll be plenty of turkey." and the grapes grew sweet and purple in August, and Turkey ate them. Grapes, lima beans, caterpillars, pea gravel, and cat food. There'll be no great jelly this year, Cat, said Mrs. Gum. But what a big, plump Thanksgiving turkey we'll have. Imagine! And the September wind blew the thorn apples off the tree, and Turkey gobbled them up as fast as they fell. Thorn apples, weed seeds, grasshoppers, ladybugs, and cat food. My, my, said Mrs. Gum. Have you ever seen a plumper bird than that cat? What a fun Thanksgiving dinner we'll have. And Mrs. Gum shelled corn in October, and turkey helped, and cat washed. And the corn will make him tasty and tender, Cat. My, what a delicious Thanksgiving dinner we'll have. And so preparations for Thanksgiving Day began early in November. And Mrs. Gum found the hatchet, and she ground some corn for cornbread. And she sharpened that hatchet. And she cooked cranberry sauce. And she honed that hatchet. And she baked pumpkin pie. And she polished that hatchet. And she mixed up an onion and chestnut stuffing. And she picked up that sharp, honed, polished hatchet and said, "Wait right here, Cat. It's time to prepare that big fat turkey." What a fun Thanksgiving dinner we'll have. What a feast! They had cornbread, all warm and crumbly and bright red, sticky sweet cranberry sauce and spicy golden pumpkin pie and a steaming bowl of fragrant onion and chestnut stuffing and cat food. "Sit right down, Cat," said Mrs. Gum. "I'll bring that nice plump turkey to the table. What a fine Thanksgiving this will be. I have so much to be thankful for. A Thanksgiving feast and two good friends to share with." Now, I think that's pure grace. That's pure grace. Prepare what you may, but in the end, we get let off too. So we should really appreciate this story. Those of us who have forgiveness of sin should appreciate this story. And it's a great one. Not all people have such a happy ending. Arnie the Stolen Markers is about a little cat who goes into a candy store with all his friends and sees this package of 20 colored markers. And he says, "Wow, could I ever use 20 colored markers?" And so he says to his sister, "Christmas, loan me some of your money that you saved and I'll buy these markers." And she says, "Oh, I don't think so. I have things I want to buy." And you know, without even thinking of it, when the storekeeper leaves the room, Arnie just sticks those markers inside his coat and runs home. And he hides them. But unfortunately, after he's gone outside, he comes back in, and his bed is made, and on top of the bed are a package of 20 markers. And his mother says, "Where did you get those markers?" And Arnie has to admit that he stole the markers. She immediately sends him back to the store to tell the man that he has stolen the markers. And he says, "I'm sorry, but my mom says I have to do something to pay for these." And the man says, "Are you ever right about that? You get this broom, and you get this mop, and you come every night after school until you have paid off those markers." And he does. And he kind of feels good about it. It kind of feels like, you know, I'm earning those markers now. And at the very end, when somebody wants him to play, he says, "Oh, I really can't." He says, "I got to go home and play with my markers, which I earned." But I think it's a good story to tell us that just because we have forgiveness doesn't mean we don't have consequences sometimes. Mm-hmm. And even children sometimes have consequences for the choices that they make. And Nancy Carlson does a good job with this one. And I have to share with you Kenneth Angus, who writes all these books and mostly has mice as characters, has a weekend with Wendell. Wendell comes to visit. And Wendell spends the weekend because his parents go on a trip. And Sophie, who is the little mouse in this family, has to put up with Wendell. And she's not really thrilled about it because Wendell makes all the rules to every game they ever play. And Wendell just says, well, I can't make the rules, I don't play. And so Sophie has to put up with this. They played house and Wendell made the rules. He was the father, the mother, and the five children, and Sophie was the dog. And then they played hospital. And Wendell was the doctor, the nurse, and the patient, and Sophie was the desk clerk. And when they pretended they worked in a bakery, Wendell was the baker, and Sophie was the sweet girl. Isn't this fun, said Wendell. And Sophie didn't say anything. But as the day went on, she said to her mother, when is Wendell going home? And his mother said, well, not right away. And so the next day they have to play another game. And at lunch he finger paints with peanut butter all over. And she says, when is Wendell leaving? And her mother says, soon, very soon. And bedtime, when Sophie put her head on her pillow, she heard something crunch, and it was a note from Wendell. And it said, see you tomorrow. And Sophie shut her eyes. I can't wait for Wendell to go home, she said. Well, the next day, as Wendell includes spreading shaving cream on her to give her a new hairdo and so on, he says, you want to go outside and wash this off? And Sophie says, I have an idea. Let's play firefighter. And so they go outside and they play firefighter, and Sophie made all the rules. And she was the fire chief and Wendell was the burning building. Isn't this fun, said Sophie. And Wendell didn't say anything. Do I get to be the fire chief, asked Wendell. Maybe, said Sophie. And soon Wendell and Sophie didn't even care who was the fire chief or who was the burning building. And in the end, when Wendell's parents come to pick him up, they say, oh, so soon? Does Wendell have to go home so soon? And Sophie says, well, when is Wendell coming back? Never, said her mother. Never, said her father. But that afternoon, when Wendell unpacked his suitcase, he heard something crunch. And it was a note from Sophie. And it said, I hope I see you soon. So kids sometimes can forgive more quickly than adults. But this happens to be one of my very favorites of Kevin Hankes. And it's Lily's purple plastic purse. And if you haven't met Lily, you will love her. Here's Red Cowboy Boots with Stars. Oh, meet Lily. I hope you like her as much as I do. Lily loved school. I love school. She loved pointy pencils. She loved the squeaky chalk. And she loved the way her boots went clickety-clickety-clack down the long, shiny hallways. Lily loved the privacy of her very own desk. She loved the fish sticks and chocolate milk every Friday in the lunchroom. And most of all, she loved her teacher, Mr. Slinger. Mr. Slinger was as sharp as a tack. He wore artistic shirts. He wore glasses on a chain around his neck. He wore a different colored tie for each day of the week. Wow, said Lily. That was just about all she could say. Wow. Now, instead of greeting students or good morning pupils, Mr. Slinger winked and said, howdy. He thought that desks in rows were old-fashioned and boring. Do you rodents think that you can handle a semicircle? And he always provided the most tasty snacks, things that were curly and crunchy and cheesy. I want to be a teacher when I grow up, said Lily. Me too, said her friends Chester and Wilson and Victor. And at home, Lily pretended to be Mr. Slinger. I am the teacher, she told her baby brother Julius. Listen up. And Lily even wanted her own set of deluxe picture encyclopedias. "What's with Lily?" asked her mother. "I thought she wanted to be a surgeon or an ambulance driver or a diva," said her father. "It must be because of her new teacher, Mr. Slinger," said her mother. "Wow," said her father. And that's just about all he could say. Wow. Whenever the students had free time, they were permitted to go to the light bulb lab in the back of the classroom. They expressed their ideas creatively through drawing and writing, and Lily went often. She had a lot of ideas. She drew pictures of Mr. Slinger. This one says, "Big friendly Mr. Nice Man Teacher." And she wrote stories about him, too. During sharing time, Lily showed her creations to the entire class. And at the very last second, Mr. Slinger saved the cold, starving, elderly. "Wow," said Mr. Slinger, and that was just about all he could say. Wow. And when Mr. Slinger had bus duty, Lily stood in line even though she didn't catch the bus. And Lily raised her hand more than anyone else in class, even if she didn't know the answer. And she volunteered to stay after school to clap erasers. "I want to be a teacher when I grow up," said Lily. "Excellent choice," said Mr. Slinger. But one Monday morning, Lily came to school especially happy. She had gone shopping with her granny over the weekend. And Lily had a new pair of movie star sunglasses, complete with glittery diamonds and a chain like Mr. Slinger's. She had three shiny quarters, and best of all, she had a brand new purple plastic purse that played a jaunty tune when it was opened. Lily wanted to show everyone. "Not now," said Mr. Slinger. "Listen to our story." And Lily just had a hard time listening. Lily really wanted to show everyone. "Not now," said Mr. Slinger. "Let's be considerate of our classmates." And Lily had a very hard time being considerate. Lily really, really wanted to show everyone. "Not now," said Mr. Slinger. "Wait until recess or sharing time," but Lily just could not wait. The glasses were so glittery, and the quarters were so shiny, and the purse played such nice music, not to mention how excellent it was for storing school supplies. "Look," Lily whispered fiercely to her friends. "Look, everyone, look what I've got." And everyone looked, including Mr. Slinger. He was not amused. "I'll just keep your things up at my desk until the end of the day," said Mr. Slinger. "They'll be safe here, and then you can take them home." Lily, stunned, alert, she felt like crying. Her glasses were gone. Her quarters were gone. Her purple plastic purse was gone. Lily longed for her purse all morning. She was even too sad to eat the snack Mr. Slinger served before recess. That afternoon, Lily went to the light bulb lab. She was still very sad. She thought, she thought, she thought, and then she became angry. She thought, she thought, she thought some more, and then she became furious. And she thought, she thought, she thought a bit longer, and then she drew a picture of Mr. Slinger. "Big, fat, mean Mr. Stealing Teacher. Claws, thief, bad, wanted by the FBI. P.S. I do not want to be a teacher when I grow up." And right before the last bell rang, Lily sneaked that drawing into Mr. Slinger's book bag. And when all the students were buttoned and zippered and snapped and tied and ready to go home, Mr. Slinger strolled over to Lily and gave her her purple plastic purse back. "It's a beautiful purse," said Mr. Slinger. "Your quarters are nice and jingly, and those glasses are absolutely fabulous. You may bring them back to school as long as you don't disturb the rest of the class." "I do do not want to be a teacher when I grow up, Lily said as she marched out of the classrooms. And on the way home, Lily opened her purse. And her glasses and quarters were still inside. And so was a note from Mr. Slinger. And it said, "Today was a difficult day. Tomorrow will be better." And there was also a small bag of tasty snacks at the bottom of that purse. And Lily's stomach lurched. She felt like crying. She felt simply awful. Lily ran all the way home and told her mother and father everything. Instead of watching her favorite cartoons, Lily decided to sit in the uncooperative chair. "I will stay here a million years if I have to. A million years for Mr. Slinger. Why does everything always happen to me? 1,051, 1,052, 1,091. And that night, Lily drew a picture of Mr. Slinger, and she wrote a story about him, too. Lily was really, really sorry. So everyone forgave her, even her parents, even her stinky baby brother, even her especially incredible teacher. And then the sun shined its smiley face down on everyone and everything, even the bugs and worms, the end. Listen up, I forgive everyone. Kind, good, nice, good, big principal. I am really, 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 really sorry." Lily's mother wrote a note. And Lily's father baked some tasty snacks for Lily to take to school the next day. "I think Mr. Slinger will understand," said Lily's mother. "Oh, I know he will," said Lily's father. And the next morning, Lily got to school early. "These are for you," Lily said to Mr. Slinger, "because I'm really, 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 really sorry." And Mr. Slinger read the story. And he looked at the picture. And he read the note. And she says, "What does it say?" And he sampled the snacks. "Oh, yum, yum." "Wow," said Mr. Slinger. That's just about all he could say. "Wow. What do you think we should do with this?" asked Mr. Slinger. Could we just throw that one away?" Lily said. "Excellent idea," said Mr. Slinger. And during sharing time, Lily demonstrated the many uses and unique qualities of her purple plastic purse, her shiny quarters, and her glittery movie star glasses. And then she did a little performance using them as props. "It's called interpretive dance," said Lily. And Mr. Slinger joined in. "Wow," said the entire class. That was just about all they could say. And throughout the rest of the day, Lily's purple plastic purse and quarters of her glasses were tucked neatly inside her desk. And she peeked at them every so often, but she did not disturb a soul. And right before the last bell rang, Mr. Slinger served Lily snacks to everyone's delight. "What do you want to be when you grow up?" asked Mr. Slinger. "A teacher!" everyone responded. And Lily's response was the loudest. "Excellent choice," said Mr. Slinger. And as the pupils filed out of the classroom, Lily held her purple plastic purse close to her heart. Mr. Slinger was right. It had been a better day. And Lily ran and skipped and hopped and flew all the way home. She was so happy. And she really did want to be a teacher when she grew up. That is, when she didn't want to be a dancer or a surgeon or an ambulance driver or a diva or a pilot or a hairdresser or a scuba diver. When you have friends that know you like, "Oh, I got this for my birthday." "And inside, and I've got three shiny quarters in here, too. Just so you know. And I don't know if you can hear it.
So they're really, Lily's purple plastic purse lives, just so you know.
But you can hardly take it to school because all the kids who hear the story want the purple plastic purse. Yeah. So you have to hang on to it yourself. But I think it's a great story of forgiveness. You know, don't we all just do things in the fit of anger and if we don't draw ugly pictures, we think them in our heads. And somebody, fortunately, sometimes is nice enough to forgive us too. Another one that I'm just going to share, but not read you the whole story. Zinni and Dot are two hens who are extremely competitive. And Zinni and Dot find themselves in both laying rather spectacular eggs, according to them, and think that they're just doing fine, but they are so fussy that while one is not looking and they're fighting, the weasel breaks in and steals one of the eggs. Well, of course, then there's only one egg left, and they're both sure it's theirs. And so they have this hard time deciding whose egg it really is, but they both know it's theirs, but they're trying not to be too presumptuous. And so they work it out, and this is a wonderful story of forgiveness in that the hens decide to cooperate. And instead of being angry at each other, they sit on the egg together. So it's kind of non-violence at a very low level of farm life here. But it's a two very cooperative hens who decide that forgiveness is better. And of course, the chicken that hatches has these two wonderful, caring people then who care for that chicken because they can't decide whose egg it really was. So it's a great story of forgiveness in a way, too. And the last one I want to just share a little bit with you. Katherine Patterson, I haven't shared a lot of older books simply because I look like a bag lady when I come up here and older books are bigger. But Katherine Patterson is a wonderful author. And I want to share with you one of the things that the book on forgiveness in practicing our faith says that I just love this idea. It says, give gifts of ourselves, that's part of forgiveness, and offer a future to someone not bound by the past. Isn't that an interesting thought? You know, we always say, yeah, you know him, or you know her. We try to bind people to their past, but part of forgiveness is to offer people a future not bound to that past. And I think Katherine Patterson does it in a very interesting way about two people, and especially the girl in the story, and how she accepts someone that other people aren't quite sure that they want to accept. But I like the way she does it. This is from the book Jacob Have I Loved, which won the Newbery Award several years ago. During the summer of 1941, every weekday morning at the top of the tide, McCall, Purnell, and I would board my skiff and go frogging for crabs. Call and I were right smart crabbers, and we could always come home with a little money, as well as plenty of crab for supper. Call was a year older than I and would never have gone crabbing with a girl except that his father was dead. So he had no man to take him on board a regular crab boat. He was, as well, a boy who had matured slowly. And being fat and nearsighted, he was dismissed by most of the island boys. Now, Carl and I made quite a pair. At 13, I was tall and large-boned with delusions of beauty and romance. He, at 14, was pudgy, bespeckled, and totally unsentimental. Carl, I would say, watching dawn break crimson over the Chesapeake Bay, I hope I have a sky like that the day I get married. Who'd marry you? Carl would ask, not meanly, just facing the facts. Oh, I said one day, I haven't met him yet. Well, then you ain't likely to. This is a right small island. Well, it won't be an islander. Mr. Rice has him a girlfriend in Baltimore. I sighed. All the girls on Rass Island were half in love with Mr. Rice, one of our two high school teachers. He was the only relatively unattached man most of us had ever known, but Mr. Rice had let it get around that his heart was given to a lady from Baltimore. Do you suppose, I asked, as I pulled skiff, the focus of my romantic musing shifting from my own wedding day to Mr. Rice's, do you suppose her parents oppose the marriage? Well, why should they care? Carl, standing on the port washboard, had sighted the head of what seemed to be a large sea terrapin and was fixing on it with fierce concentration, and I shifted the pole to starboard. We could get a pretty low price for a terrapin of that size.
The terrapin sensed the change in our direction and dove straight through the eelgrass into the bottom mud, but Call had the net waiting, and so that when the old bull hit his hiding place, he was yanked to the surface and deposited into a waiting pail. Call grunted with satisfaction. We might make as much as 50 cents on that one catch, 10 times the price of a soft blue crab. Maybe she's got some mysterious illness and doesn't want to be a burden to him. Who? Mr. Rice's fiance. Mr. Rice's finance. I picked up the word, but not the pronunciation for my reading. It was not in the spoken vocabulary of most islanders. His what? The woman he's engaged to marry, stupid. How come you think she's sick? Well, something is delaying the consummation of their union. And Paul jerked his head around to give me one of his looks, but the washboards of a skipper are precarious perch at best, so he didn't stare long enough to waste time or risk a dunking. He left me to what he presumed to be my looniness and gave his attention to the eelgrass. We were a good team on the water. I could pull a skiff quickly and quietly, and nearsighted as he was, he could spy a crab by just the tip of the claw through grass and muck. He rarely missed one, and he knew I wouldn't jerk or swerve at the wrong moment. I'm sure that's why he stuck with me. I stuck with him not only because we could work well together, but because our teamwork was so automatic that I was free to indulge my romantic fantasies most of the time. That this part of my nature was wasted on Call didn't matter. He didn't have any friends but me, so he wasn't likely to repeat what I said to someone who might snicker. Call himself never laughed. I thought of it as a defect in his character that I must try to correct, so I told him jokes. Do you know why radio announcers have tiny hands? Huh? We pause for station identification. I would whoop. Yeah. Well, don't you get it, Cole? We pause. We pause. I let go of the pole to shake my right hand at him. You know, little hands pause. You ain't never seen one. What? One radio announcer. No. Well, then how do you know how big their hands are? I don't. It's a joke, Call. Well, I don't see how it can be a joke if you don't even know if they've got big hands or little hands. Suppose they really have big hands. Then you ain't even telling the truth. Then what happens to your joke? It's just a joke, Call. It doesn't matter whether it's true or not. It matters to me. Why should a person think a lie is funny? Never mind, Call. Doesn't matter. But he went on, mumbling like a little old preacher about the importance of truth and how you couldn't trust radio announcers anymore. Well, you'd think I'd give up, but I didn't. Call, did you hear about the lawyer, the dentist, and the pea psychiatrist who died and went to heaven? Was it an airplane crash? No, Call, it's a joke. Oh, a joke. Yeah, you see, this lawyer and this dentist and this pea psychiatrist all died. And first the lawyer gets there, and Peter says, Peter who? Peter in the Bible, the Apostle Peter. He's dead. I know he's dead, but you just said. Just shut up and listen to the joke, Call. This lawyer comes to Peter, and he wants to get into heaven. A minute ago, he said he was already in heaven. Well, he wasn't. He was just at the pearly gates, okay? Anyhow, he says he wants to get into heaven, and Peter says he's sorry, but he's looked at the book, and the lawyer was wicked and evil and cheated people, so he's got to go to hell. Does your mother know you use words like that? Call. Even the preacher talks about hell. Anyhow, this lawyer has to give up and go to hell. And then this dentist comes up and he wants to get into heaven. And Peter looks at his book and says that this guy pulled people's teeth out just to get their money, even when their teeth were perfectly good and he knew it. He did what? Call, it doesn't matter. It don't matter that a dentist pulls out perfectly good teeth just to make money? That's awful. He ought to go to jail. Well, we went to hell for it. Out perfectly good teeth. And he mumbled, pinching his own with the fingers of his left hand. And then the pea psychiatrist, the what?
I was an avid reader of Time magazine, which beside the day-old Baltimore Sun was our porthole on the world in those days. So although psychiatry was not yet a popular pastime, I was quite aware of the word, even though I didn't know that the P was silent. Time was probably the source of the joke I was laboring to recount. Well, this P psychiatrist is a doctor who works with people who are crazy. Well, why would you try to do anything with people who are crazy? To get them well, to get their minds better, good heavens. And we paused and had a huge male crab, a true number one Jimmy, swimming double over a she crab, and she was taking her, he was taking her to the thick eelgrass where she would shed for the last time and become a grown-up lady crab, a soap. And when she was soft, there'd be a proper crab wedding, of course, with the groom staying around to watch out for his bride until her shell was hard once more and she could protect herself and her load of eggs on her own. Sorry, Mr. Jimmy, I said no wedding bells for you. Now, this old Jimmy didn't much like being deprived of his sweetheart, but Carl just pinched him from behind and threw each of them in a separate bucket. She was a rank peeler. That is, it wouldn't be more than a couple hours before she shed. Our bucket for rank peelers was almost full. It was a good day on the water. Well, like I was saying, this pea psychiatrist comes up to Peter, and Peter looks him up in the Book of Judgment and finds out he's been mean to his wife and kids, and he tells him to go to hell. What? I ignored him. Otherwise, I'd never get this story. So the pea psychiatrist starts to leave, and then Peter says all of a sudden, "Hey, did you say you were a pea psychiatrist?" And the guy says, "Yes, I did." And I was talking so fast now I was almost out of breath. And Peter says, "I think we can use you around here after all. You see, we got this problem. God thinks he's Franklin Delano Roosevelt." God what? Well, you know when people are crazy called, they think they're somebody important like Napoleon or something? Well, he's God is important. It's a joke, Carl. How can it be a joke? There ain't nothing funny. There's nothing funny about it. He had broken into a waterman's emphatic negative. Carl, it's funny because Franklin D. Roosevelt has got too big for his britches, like he's better than God or something. But that's not what you said. You said, "I know what I said, but you got to understand politics." Well, what kind of joke is that? Fiddle. And Carl's cuss words were taught to him by his sainted grandmother, intended to be as quaint as the clothes she made for him. And when the sun was high and our stomachs empty, Carl stepped off the washboards into the boat, and I shipped the pole and moved up with him to the forward thwart where we put the oars into the locks and rowed the boat out of the eelgrass into deeper water and around the harbor. Anyway, this whole story shows two people that accept each other just the way they are. The girl who's telling the story has a twin sister who everybody thinks is absolutely wonderful. And her parents think she's absolutely wonderful. And all the stories center around the twin, whereas this girl, who accepts Carl for who he is, just a little slow, is very happy if her parents give her any kind of recognition. And it's the struggle and the forgiveness involved in family relationships and the forgiveness and acceptance of people unlike ourselves. Beautifully written story by Catherine Patterson.
I've used her short stories for sermons during Advent especially. She has a collection called Angels and Other Strangers.
Yes.
And I've never read that book, but all these short stories are so much like that. She has such a gift of understanding kids, you know, and how, and but they're very powerful, grace-centered stories.
They are. And she told a story once to a group about a friend of hers when she got back. Her parents were missionaries in China. And when she got back, how she was a misfit because all of her clothes were from the barrel that people used to send to missionaries. And she was living in South Carolina, and the only other misfit in that group was a boy that was so huge who wanted to be a ballet dancer. Mm-hmm. And they bonded because she felt a misfit in her way. He felt a misfit in his way. Because he said, first of all, in South Carolina, when you're big, you don't admit you want to be a ballet dancer. But the wonderful part of that story was years later, when she was living in Vermont and went to New York, she happened to go into New York for a ballet because her son was learning ballet to be part of a play in high school. And at this ballet school, she saw a picture of that young man who had indeed become a ballet dancer.
Aww.
and the powerful image of that and her acceptance of that. And she said she met him years later, and he again was rather large and rather unconventional. But she said she always keeps the image of that young man on that ballet poster that she saw, knowing that dreams do come true, and that people have hidden talents and skills that they sometimes are able to share. It was just beautiful. She's a beautiful lady. She wrote Bridge to Terabithia, if you haven't read that, about the death of a young boy's friend. That is a real, was based on an accident that happened to a friend of her son's. And she won the Newbery for that also. She's one of those wonderful authors who's won the Newbery twice.
A little bit on healing. There are a lot of good books on healing. I think Smoky Night is a book on healing. It won the Caldecott Medal a number of years ago. There's a couple of sentences in here I think that are powerful about how healing can take place, especially among people that are different. And this is a sad book in some ways, but a wonderful book too. Mom and I stand well back from our window looking down. I'm holding Jasmine, my cat. We don't have our lights on, though it's almost dark. People are rioting in the street below. Mom explains about rioting. It can happen when people get angry. They want to smash and destroy. They don't care anymore what's right and what's wrong. Below us, they were smashing everything. Windows, cars, street lights. They look angry. They look happy, too, I whisper. After a while, it's like a game, Mama says. Two boys are carrying a TV from Morton's Appliances. It's hard for them because the TV is so heavy. Are they stealing it? I ask, and Mama nods. Someone breaks the window of fashion shoes, and two women and a man climb in through the broken glass, and they toss out shoes like they're throwing footballs. I've never heard anybody laugh the way they laugh. Smoke drifts, light as fog, and I see the distant flicker of flames. Across the street from us, people are dragging cartons of cereal and sacks of rice from Kim's Market. My mama and I don't go to Mrs. Kim's Market, even though it's close. Mama says it's better if we buy from our own people. Mrs. Kim's cat and my cat fight all the time. Jasmine in words I can't understand. She's yelling the same kind of words now at the people who are stealing her stuff. They pay no attention. I move behind Mama. Will they come here? Well, there's nothing for them here, Daniel. See? They finished with our street. They're moving on. Our street is empty. One last man is staggering under a pile of clothes he's taken from the dry cleaners. The plastic bags are still over them. We'll sleep together tonight, Mama tells me. And she makes me wash my face and brush my teeth. I'm going to take off my shoes, but leave on my clothes. She puts me next to the wall, and I hold Jasmine. I can't sleep, I say. Shh, Mama whispers, just close your eyes. I do. I guess I sleep. Next thing I know, Mama's shaking me. Quick, Daniel, get up. There's a terrible smell of smoke. Someone's pounding on our apartment door. Fire! Fire! And I'm suddenly awake. Where's Jasmine? And I run to the closet. Sometimes Jasmine sleeps on the shelf. Mama's screaming at me. We can't wait. Jasmine's gone. Put on your shoes. Hurry! We rush down the stairs, and others crowd around us, and the smoke makes me cough, and Mr. Ramirez is in front of us carrying Lissa and the baby, who are both howling. Those people are hooligans, he shouts over his shoulder. Hooligans! Mrs. Ramirez is ahead of him. She's holding the cage with Loco the parrot, and Loco's squawking something awful. Did you see Jasmine, Mr. Ramirez, I shout. And he shakes his head, but I don't think he even hears me. Don't touch the railing, he warns, it's hot. And outside the sky is hazy orange, and flames pounce up the side of our building. And three fire engines scream to a stop, and firefighters jump out running, pulling hoses, and I see our window where Mom and I stood. Fire hasn't reached us yet. Is everybody out? One firefighter yells. Far as we know, another says. Did you see a cat? I ask him. She's yellow. Maybe she's still in there. And he glances down. Probably not, son. Cats are plenty smart. She'll be long gone. A lady comes up to us. There's a shelter you can come to, she says. Everyone follow me. I'm crying because I'm not sure Jasmine is all that smart. What if she's still inside?
Some of the streetlights have been smashed, and they walk along the sidewalk, which sparkles with broken glass. There are empty cartons everywhere, and a street sign lies crumpled in the gutter. I grab hold of Mama because I think I see a dead man with no arms lying there, too. But it's just one of those plastic people that show off clothes in department stores. And the lady looks back at Mrs. Kim, who's trailing along behind us. "Are you all right?" she calls. Mrs. Kim nods. "We're almost at the shelter," the lady tells her. The shelter is a church hall. There are cots to sleep on and a table with hot drinks, and two men are making sandwiches. I've never seen a bigger jar of mayo. We see people from our building, and they're talking about who did this and what will happen to us. "It's a sad, sad night," Mr. Jackson says. I ask him about Jasmine. He says he's pretty sure he saw her. "She got out, Daniel," he tells me. I hope he's not just trying to make him feel better. "Did you see my cat?" Mrs. Kim asks. "He's orange. He's the color of carrots," I say, and I almost add, "he's fat and mean," but I don't. A girl gives me a mug of hot chocolate. I wish it had more sugar. But when I finish drinking it, Mama says I should lie down. She's always making me lie down. People keep coming, and some of them are crying, and one woman screams and screams, and I hide under my blanket. And then Mama says, "Jamie, look." And there is the firefighter who is at our building, and he's standing in the open door with a smoky knife behind him, and I see that he's carrying a cat under each arm. And that was how Mr. Rammer is carried, listening to the baby, and the cats are howling, too. "Jasmine!" And the blanket's caught on my foot, and I'm trailing it. "Oh, thank you for coming here." "The other cat is mine," Mrs. Kim takes her big, fat, mean old orange cat and holds him close. "I'm kissing Jasmine. She smells the smoke." "Where was she?" I ask the firefighter, and the two of them are under the stairs yowling and screeching, he says, and he takes a mug of hot chocolate. I like him so much I wish I had a whole barrel of sugar for his drink. "The cats were together?" Mrs. Kim asks, and the firefighter nods. "They were so scared they were holding paws." I grin. "No, they weren't." "What about our building?" Mr. Ramirez asks. "The fire's out. You'll be able to go back in a day or two." A woman puts down a dish of milk. "Here, kitty, kitty," she calls. Jasmine jumps out of my arms, and Miss Kim puts her carrot-colored cat down, too. Cats drink from the same dish. Milk isn't even that good for cats, but I don't say that either. "Look at that." And Mama is all amazed. "I thought those two didn't like each other." Listen to this. "They probably didn't know each other," I explain. "Now they do." Everyone looks at me, and it's suddenly very quiet. "Did I say something wrong?" "Is there Mama?" "No, Daniel." And Mama's tugging at her fingers the way she does when she's nervous. "My name is Gina," she yells at Mrs. Kim. "Perhaps when things settle down, you and your cat will come over and share a dish of milk with us." I think that's pretty funny. Nobody. Mrs. Kim picks up her cat and strokes him, and she's staring at the wall. Maybe she's not going to say anything, but then she looks across at Mama. "Thank you," she says. "We will come." And Mama smiles, and I reach out and stroke Mrs. Kim's big old orange cat, too. "Can you hear him, Mrs. Kim?" I ask. "He's purring." Now, I think the line, "they didn't know each other," has a lot to say about healing. Perhaps we can't heal each other because we don't know each other. And so we do those wonderful stereotypical things of putting people in groups that don't really fit. That's called a smoky knife. The Kissing Hand is put out by the Child Welfare League, and I just found this book this year. But I think it says something about healing, and especially in regard to our wonderful children that the Lord has placed in our blessing, for our blessing. Chester Raccoon stood at the edge of the forest and cried, "I don't want to go to school," he told his mother. "I want to stay home with you. And I want to play with my friends and play with my toys and read my books and swing on my swing. Please, may I stay home with you?" And Mrs. Raccoon took Chester by the hand and nuzzled him on the ear. "Sometimes we all have to do things we don't want to do," she told him gently, "even if they seem strange and scary at first, but you will love school once you start."
You'll make new friends, and you'll play with new toys, and you'll read new books, and swing on new swings. And besides, she said, I have a wonderful secret that will make your nights at school seem as warm and cozy as your days at home. And Chester wiped away his tears, and he looked interested. A secret? What kind of a secret? A very old secret, said Mrs. Raccoon. I learned it from my mother, and she learned it from hers. It's called the kissing hand. The kissing hand? Asked Chester. What's that? Well, I'll show you. Mrs. Raccoon took Chester's left hand and spread open his tiny fingers into a fan, and leaning forward, she kissed Chester right in the middle of his palm. And Chester felt his mother's kiss rush from his hand and up his arm and right into his heart. And even his silky black mask tingled with a special warmth. And Mrs. Raccoon smiled. Now, she told Chester, whenever you feel lonely and need a little loving from home, you just press your hand to your cheek and think, Mommy loves you, Mommy loves you, and that very kiss will just jump to your face and fill you with toasty warm thoughts. And she took Chester's hand and she carefully wrapped his fingers around the kiss. Now, do be careful not to lose it, she teased him, but don't worry. When you open your hand and wash your food, I promise that kiss will stick. And Chester loved his kissing hand. Now he knew his mother's love would go with him wherever he went, even to school. And that night, Chester stood in front of his school and he looked thoughtful. And suddenly he turned to his mother and grinned. Give me your hand, he told her. And Chester took his mother's hand in his own and unfolded their large familiar fingers into a fan. And next he just leaned forward and kissed the center of her hand. Now you have a kissing hand too, he told her. And with a gentle goodbye and I love you, Chester turned and danced away. And Mrs. Raccoon watched Chester scamper across a tree limb at their school. And as the hoot owl rang in the new school year, she pressed her left hand to her cheek and she just smiled. And the warmth of Chester's kiss filled her heart with special words. Chester loves you, it sang. Chester loves you. And I think that can be a very healing thing for both the young and the old, called The Kissing Hand. And the final one I just want to tell you about, I love this book. George Shen wrote this book. He now lives up on Woodby Island. And George Shannon said, when he was talking about this book, this didn't really happen, but this is what I wanted to happen. And it tells about a father who very kindly leaves another brother at home and takes this younger brother and says, do you want to go see Kansas Mountains? Well, there aren't any mountains in Kansas. And his father said, what, you know, but I'm going to show you Kansas Mountains. Come with me. And by himself, he gets to travel with his father. And where his father takes, he loves the thought of going through the town that he loves so much. And then he sees the silos, the grain elevators. And his father, who works there, says, the thing that makes a mountain is a high, quiet view. Are you ready? Ready. And inside, as we climb, my father told me of the times he climbed before, like the day I was born. Step, step, over step, up as high as 8 houses stacked like blocks. And when we got to the top, we didn't say a word. We could talk anywhere, but we couldn't see all this anyplace but here.
And everyone I knew, every garden, every house was way down below with cool, wide sky between there and me. School would have fit in my desk at school. And our house was hiding under trees like a sneaky cat. And fields of wheat, still golden, others cut to brown, were all small as our own little square beans at home. And all was flat like the dining room table. But he felt he had been on a text on a Kansas mountain because he could look down and see all of Kansas below him. And it's a true story of healing between a father and a son. A father took the time to spend time with a son who found it very healing. But it was just sad to hear George Shannon say, this is what I wanted to happen. But maybe that's the power of story. We know about what we want to happen. Okay, thank you. These are forgiveness and healing. If you have other suggestions, does anybody have any others that you could suggest that you know? Yes, sir.
Did you read some more?
Did I read some more?
Did you ever, how come you said P?
P psychiatrist? She didn't know that, it was the letter P in front of the word psychiatry, and she didn't know it was supposed to be silent. So she said P psychiatrist every time she said that word.
But P is bathroom talk.
You are absolutely right. Only kids. I was reading my kids a story about the magic porridge pot, and in that story, the porridge pot spills all over. And it said at the end of the story, and people came out with plates and platters and pots and pans, and everyone ate porridge. And this little kid raised his hand in first grade, and he said, what's a platter? And I said, oh, you don't know what a platter is? I said, well, does anybody know what a platter is? This little kid said, yes, it's right here by your side. Sometimes they call it a gallbladder.